Good afternoon, everybody. My name is, well, you may call me Fluffy. I am the coordinator, the event producer, if you will, for the Speaker's Corner for the Oracle at Erowid. We have 3 days of talks about the future of all sorts of different things. I myself, as the event producer, have stolen time slots that I wanted. Today, the future of me. Tomorrow, the future of us. And Thursday, closing the event, the future of all. Today's program begins with me, Fluffy, continues with Brooke and
Tengu.
Thank you. Formerly known as Eric Davis and Jennifer Dumbert, discussing the poetry of Wallace Stevens. And then finally closing with Zidant Functionerowid, discussing This Is Your Brain on the Future. Come in, come in. We hope you can join us 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock every day here at the Erowid Dome at the Oracle at Erowid.
Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Or is it every day?
No, you're right.
Tuesday,
thank
Wednesday,
you.
Thursday.
It just seems like every day.
Yeah.
If you keep going, we'll probably still talk again.
It's true, but less formally.
And so.
Stay out. You're upside down.
Let us begin. My little talk today is called The Future of Me. In the long run, we're all dead. Now, that's a witty aphorism. And it produces a bit of a nervous laugh. That nervous laugh comes from the fact that in your heart, you know it's true. We have a consciousness of death. It's very particular to human. As near as we can tell, none of the other animals actually possess the same consciousness of death that we do. And it's really interesting because although we are possessed of this consciousness of death, we spend nearly our entire lives avoiding it. You can make a reasonable argument that the descent into the material world, into consumerism, is an attempt to avoid the sense of impending catastrophe which awaits all of us. And yet, unless you believe the Extropians with their technologically mediated singularity, which will free us of the meat body and translate us into eternal energetic forms, in the long run, we are all dead. What does this mean? Now, this is a question which arguably is the foundation for all religions, for all religious experience, because it comes down to two questions that get asked continuously and in parallel. When will I die? And what happens after I die? And you take a look at the different traditions and they have different answers on this. Christianity says you die and you go to heaven if you have been saved. Buddhism says, well, it's sort of the different schools have sort of different theories on this, right? Tibetan Buddhism, that school, which I know at least in passing enough to talk about, says that you go into a Bardo realm and that the attachments, the things that you didn't quite work out on this plane, becomes the points that lure you back into physical manifestation after you pass through the Bardo realm. Islam, you go to paradise. Judaism, if you lived a good life, that's good enough. Who knows what happens next? And so we alternate between obsessing about these issues, what they mean to us, and avoiding them completely. And we sort of are in this bifurcated state where it's one or the other, or one or the other. We're thinking about it, we're avoiding it, we're thinking about it, we're avoiding it. And yet, so many religious traditions have as a foundational element the fact that the initiate needs to emphasize their own consciousness of mortality. That this, in fact, is the beginning of wisdom, because it's a goad to self-work. That you will, in fact, work on yourself You will improve yourself if you understand that this is all you get. Because one thing the traditions basically agree on is that the physical plane is where you get to work that out. That once you're dead, that's done. You can't do that anymore. You can't evolve. It's over. Whatever you finished up with when you leave the material plane, that's pretty much all she wrote.
Makes death count sound kind of boring.
Well, this is the plane where it's all happening, because this is the plane where karma and matter meet, and they get to have it out. And it's the only place, as far as we know, where you can get work done. It's the stage. It's the platform for our evolution or its opposite. And this is it. It's here, it's now, there's no there but here, and there's no time but now. This is it. And we know all of this. Every one of us knows all of this. We're born knowing all of this, even if we half ignore it. And of course, when we half ignore it, it pops up in our shadow, in our nightmares. And all of this is really only for one reason. It haunts us in this way because no man knows the day and hour of his own death. But what if we did? What if we knew when we were to die? What happens then? How does that change things? And this does happen all the time. Consider someone who's had a diagnosis of terminal cancer. They know, okay, they may not know it's tomorrow, but they know in the next 6 minutes, pardon me, they know in the next 6 months, they're checking out. What happens to these people? Well, we know, Kubler-Ross studied this. They go through five stages. We all know them: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. We all know this is actually a fundamental part of our culture now. And when people have reached the end, when they've had enough time to go through this entire process, and they've made the journey from denial to acceptance, when that happens, not universally, but a lot of the time, these people are transformed. The chaff in their lives has been completely burned away. It's the veil of Maya that's been penetrated by this condition, by this absolute knowledge of their own mortality. And so those who have made their peace with this, this oncoming inevitability, which is as true for all of us as it is for them, they become holy themselves. If they have evolved in this passage through the world, they're very nearly holy. They're almost saints. And they're ready to release their grip. And I think we've probably all met people in our passage through life at that stage and gotten that sense from them. Because it's empowering. Once you've gotten to that place, it's empowering, because at that point, only that which truly matters remains, and remains focused in the mind, and remains focused in the being. Now, there are rare cases when the inevitable gets postponed. There's a miracle cure, there's a remission, there's a new treatment that comes in and saves the day. And when that happens, when those individuals recover, more often than not, they are permanently transformed by that experience, by that absolute consciousness of their own mortality. So there's no real going back to the before. There's no forgetting. Instead, the fear with which they greeted the inevitable has been replaced by love and by hope. And these are extraordinary people, and they're in extraordinary situations. But what if, by some amazing chance, each of us, in some point in our lives, found out our expiration date? What if the extraordinary became absolutely run-of-the-mill? It seems impossible, unless you're going to argue for a sort of Logan's Run system.
Woo!
Yet it does happen. So, for example, how many of you have read Breaking Open the Head, Daniel Pinchbeck's book? Quite a good book. Eric, you've read it? And there's a little story that's sort of tossed off somewhat out of hand in the beginning of that book, and also I think it's reprised at the beginning of 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, that he's traveling, I believe, in Ghana to go meet the Bwiti to take Ibogaine with this fellow who I believe is driving him around, who announces very blithely that he knows the day that he's going to die. and he's in his 30s, like 32, 33. And the day is coming up pretty soon, and that's just the way it is, and Pinchbeck reports that's the day he died. It was a car accident or something, I believe. It just sort of took him out. What's really interesting when I read that, because I read that, and it made me very, very uncomfortable because it hit a little bit too close to home. For you see, this is the future of me. And like you, I know that I will die. Unlike you, I happen to know when. Now, people will ask, and you're probably thinking, how the hell do you know this? Floppy, you're just gone. What do you mean? Now, the only thing that I can offer up by any way of explanation is that it's revealed knowledge, all right? I learned it a bit over a decade ago when I sought an answer to the question. And let me tell you, you should be really careful before you phrase questions because you may not really want to know the answer. And in retrospect, a fair argument could be made that I shouldn't have asked that question because I found out the answer to that question. And ever since then, I've had to deal with the fact that I have the answer to that question. Now, here's the rub. To the best of my own ability, and whatever ability that is, I'm a shaman. I don't really make any apology for that. That's what I am. And some of the things, some of the capabilities or gifts that come with being a shaman, one of the things that comes as part of the factory installed package, is that if you want to, you can find out your expiration date. That is part of the deal. See, McKenna said in one of his talks that a shaman has been to the end. And that's just, no, we're not talking about just the eschaton with the end. We're talking about the end, your end, not just the big end, the end. Shamans get that. That's part of the kit. And very specifically for shamans, that's what it is. Anyone who is a shaman, I have a feeling there's probably a few of them in this room, if you want, you can get that information. June 2009. When I learned this 11 years ago, it seemed very far away. Rather less so now. So, in my countdown to personal extinction, I've just clocked under the 3-year mark. And people ask, how can you believe this, Fluffy? How can you believe this? And the only thing that I can say on that is that I have sought confirmations repeatedly, trust me, or disconfirmations. And every time the same answer comes back, just remains the same. Every time, every time, every time. In the long run, we're all dead. I just happen to know when. And it is possible.
Can we change the investment strategies at all?
We'll come to that. We will come to that. It is possible. It is just possible that I do know. This is not a completely improbable thing to believe. Pinchbeck wasn't telling lies. Obviously, he encountered someone in this life who did. Now, I have conjectures to the cause of my death, but they're conjectures, and we're not going to go into it. But what remains the fixed star in my own personal universe is the running length of this particular film, which is 46 years, 6 months, and 11 days. Now, I don't want to dwell just yet on the possibility that this is all just fantasy. All right? Not quite yet. Instead, what I want to talk about is how this knowing has changed me. At first, of course, it scared me to death, internally. I did not want to know this, but I did, and once I did, there was no going back. It was irreversible. And I knew that I could then measure out my days and hours. I could play the percentages around my time remaining. And I was fortunate, in one sense, because of something that had happened 2 years before this, and that I had a sense of what was coming. In November of 1993, Thanksgiving weekend, I'd been out at a 2-day-long party Thanksgiving party at friends on the other side of the city, and I come in, my phone has been ringing and ringing and ringing. Of course, this is an age before mobile phones, so when you were away from your phone, you were essentially out of touch. And I pick up the phone, and it's a friend. I don't even remember the friend's name now. But he was the boyfriend of another friend of mine, David. And David and I had grown to be very close friends because David and I had been to a party together, and David was dosed with acid, and David had never taken acid before, and David was not prepared for acid, and I babysat him for the 2 hours until he got into it, and then he went off in the party and had a very good time. But from that moment, we developed an extremely strong friendship. And we worked together magically, we were in a coven together, and we had done fun stuff. We didn't know a lot about the details of our personal lives, but we were very, very good friends. We checked in with each other occasionally. So the phone rings, and it's David's boyfriend. And he tells me that David's been in a coma for 3 days, that he has toxoplasmosis, which is one of the outcomes of AIDS, and that he's been on a respirator for 70 hours, and they like to turn it off at 72. Would I mind coming down to the hospital? So I jumped in a cab and went over to the other side of San Francisco to the intensive care ward of San Francisco General. And they turned off all of the various equipment one by one, and they dosed him up full of morphine. And what was interesting was not so much what was going on in his body, but what was going on in his monitor, because you could watch the respiration and you could watch the heart rate. And what I saw, and I'm sure there's a chaotic attractor which describes this, was something in the monitor that looked like nothing so much as a leaf in a gentle breeze, slowly and circuitously fluttering. That was just about dusk. And the monitors were reading that he was dead. And he was there, though, I could see in the body. And I remember just sort of looking away, and it was the barest, it was like nystagmus, just bam, bam. And in that instantaneous moment of time, when I looked back, there was a corpse, which was frightening because I'd never actually really seen a corpse before. And David was gone. So something happened in a twinkling of an eye. I don't know what it was. I don't have any name for it, but there was an exit, and David left. Now, before this, I had absolutely no evidence for the empirical existence of the soul. Nothing. I mean, you talk about it, you think you feel it, and then, of course, it departs, and it's completely apparent. It's just completely, you know, there's a person, there's a corpse. Bam. So what's the difference there? A soul. That's what it is. And it was not something that I had been prepared for. I had not really even signed up for this ride. And it was something that I was, as a result, forced to confront. So I had seen death before I learned my own expiration date. And from seeing David's death, after weeks of wrestling with this thing that just didn't fit with anything that I understood or had been taught, I came up with something that I knew was an answer to this original question about death, about dying, about when we go. And I've reduced it, and I apologize in advance, but I reduced it to a bit of an aphorism. It matters only how much you love and how much you are loved. That in the end, when it's just a corpse on that table, that is the only thing of any importance whatsoever. So given that, and given the intimate knowledge of my own expiration date, what then is to be done? Two months after David died, I gave an invited lecture at a very fancy Bay Area think tank. They were expecting, you know, little technology, VR, blah, blah, blah stuff, and they hadn't specifically requested that, but that's pretty much what they thought they signed up for. What they got instead was as much unfiltered truth as I could actually find a way to deliver. Instead of PowerPoint slides, they got chanting. instead of a lecture, they got a techno-pagan ritual. It was nuts. It was completely nuts. And it could have destroyed the reputation that I was actually just starting to build at that point. But it didn't. And it wouldn't have mattered. I would have done it just the same. Because I screwed up my courage, and the thing that fixed my courage to the sticking point was the memory of the fact that the only thing that mattered was how much that you love and how much you are loved. And the reason that I am here, right here, today, with all of you, talking about these things right now, is because of David. Is because David, in his dying, gave me one of the most magnificent, unasked for, and holy gifts I could ever be given, to be able to discern what is truly important. Everything that I have tried to share since that happened, I have tried to share with love. I'm not perfect, God knows it. All of you who know me well know that really well. And the message, sometimes it gets cloudy, it's not always clear. It's clouded by my own attachments. But time is growing short, and it's time for me to speak plainly about the things that truly matter. And that begins today, right here with me. Now, what if I'm wrong? All right. This knowing has changed me. It's affected the criteria by which I make my decisions. All right? I haven't saved for my retirement. I haven't bored myself into a tenured sinecure at a university. I get a fair number of offers for things like that. Because why? Because what for? Because I have better things to do. And yes, it's given an odd shape to my existence. Long-term planning, 5 years or more, I ignore it. It's not so much that I'm living in the moment as I'm running against the clock. A friend of mine recently commented that he'd seen in me the emergence of a drive unlike anything he'd ever seen in me when I was younger. And I think that's one manifestation of this shape of my life. I'm in a hurry. There's a lot to do. And I have less than 3 years to get it all done. And everything that comes into my life, every opportunity, is measured against that clock. Now, if I'm wrong, what have I really lost here, all right? I'll be embarrassed.
We'll haunt you because I'm 20th.
I'll be chagrined.
We'll
all have a really good laugh about it. But if I had it to do all over again, would I have done it any differently? Because in the end, in the long run, we're all dead. Thank you. Do you guys want a small break?